It is.
What I meant by what works is he's giving a message and he's saying, and he's thinking to himself later, oh, you know, I should have included this. I didn't prove my point very well. I should have left this out and included this.
I think it just goes without saying he probably got better with more experience at defending the faith, but I don't, I would just never do what Gordon Clark does and take like one of Paul's sermons and say he blew it.
Yeah.
And he learned from his mistake. So there's some guys who think that at Mars Hill, because Paul didn't mention the crucifixion as far as we know, only the resurrection, that Paul blew it. And it's like, no, he did not blow it. It's one of the greatest sermons. You can go to Mars Hill today and still see the Greek of Paul's sermon. And I'm telling you, the Greeks were much more open to a God dying than they were to a God rising. The scandal for the Jews was Jesus crucified. The foolishness to the Greeks was pretty much Jesus risen. They didn't want anything to do with a resurrection. So there's no way he watered it down or anything, but
I didn't say he made a mistake. I just said he's thinking the process through.
Yeah. And there have been a lot of that. I just don't want to get it to the point where where he wasn't. Some will act like, you know, till he started his missionary journeys, he didn't have his theology set in stone or whatever. But okay, let's get to this. We got about an hour left. We got four sections to try to cover. So if we get through two of the sections, we'll be good. Well, there's a short. I'm going to shortcut the next section, so we might be able to get through a little bit more. We'll see. But arguments for God's existence. You've got Augustine's argument from Unchangeable Truths. Remember, St. Augustine was Platonic in his thought. So you had the world of forms, the world of ideas, these eternal unchanging ideas. So Augustine would say eternal unchanging truths exist, such as 7 plus 3 equals 10. But temporal changeable minds cannot account for the existence of these eternal, unchangeable truths. See, if your time-bound, changing mind adds 7 plus 3 and you come up with 11, the eternal, unchanging truth that 7 plus 3 equals 10 stands in judgment on that and corrects you. So these eternal, unchanging truths stand above human minds, okay? And I don't think Plato ever really explained it. He just got them kind of hanging there. But Augustine puts these eternal unchanging ideas in a mind. He said ideas don't make sense unless they exist in a mind. But if they're eternal unchanging ideas, their source must be an eternal unchanging mind. So only an eternal unchangeable mind can be the cause of the existence of eternal unchangeable truth. So in other words, he's arguing from these eternal unchanging ideas, there has to be a rational God who exists as the source of these ideas. Okay? Descartes had an argument from imperfection. I have imperfect ideas, doubts, mistakes, but one cannot know that an idea is imperfect unless he has a knowledge of the idea of perfection. So you can't say that line is crooked unless you are ready. That presupposes that you have an idea of a straight line first. So Descartes, and this, by the way, is another Platonic argument, by the way. But an imperfect mind cannot produce the idea of perfection. Only a perfect mind can cause my idea of perfection. So that was Descartes. I'm not real thrilled about that particular. I like Augustine's, but I'm not real thrilled about that argument. Now, Thomas Aquinas had five ways to prove God's existence. And the first three are cosmological. And let's write down the main types. You got the cosmological. This is where you argue for God as the cause of the universe, the uncaused cause of everything else that exists. Okay, God is the cause of the universe. The teleological argument is from design. The design in the universe needs an intelligent designer. The moral argument absolute or universal, unchanging moral laws, absolute moral laws need a moral lawgiver or an absolute moral lawgiver. You got Augustine's from eternal truths. Points to an eternal mind. You have the absurdity of life without God, which just means what it says. You have C.S. Lewis's argument from reason. And that's human reason. Must have a rational cause. See, when Christians think, that's perfectly consistent with our worldview. When Christians think, because Christians believe that a rational God created us in His image, so we're rational beings, and He created the universe in a way that makes sense, so that through reason we could find out about the world in which we live. So it makes sense when we trust our reason. Yeah, the atheist really believes that time plus chance plus matter somehow produced human reason that really does help us to find truth. So the atheist has no reason to trust, no good reason to trust in his reason. Okay? So C.S. Lewis would say reason with a small r necessitates the existence of reason with a capital R. Okay, this argument is becoming more and more popular. I always liked it because the presuppositionalist Cornelius Van Til really used it without, he thought it was his own argument, his own transcendental argument, but it's actually the same type of argument as C.S. Lewis.
I'm confused. There are six up there. What am I thought these were the five.
I'm just doing this off the top of my head because as we talk about these, when I tell you that the first three of Aquinas' arguments are cosmological, you'll be able to look up there and say, oh, I see what he's saying.
Okay.
And and let me see if there's a... See if there's any other that I should... there's different kinds of... Yeah, so now we'll get back to this. And you know, we could view other things as pointers for God too, like guilt. Guilt is knowledge that we've done something wrong. And I did not think this was a strong argument for God until I read Sigmund Freud's explanation about where guilt came from. And it was so wild and so far-fetched that it was like, wow, guilt is a powerful argument for God. You mentioned earlier about God put eternity in our hearts from Ecclesiastes. Our fear of death. You know, we don't know. We might die peacefully in our sleep with no pain, but we still fear death. Why? Because it's what comes after death that we're worried about. So we do think about eternal issues. That's why when people are on their deathbed, very rarely do they call for their favorite atheist philosopher. They want a preacher or a priest by their side. And so we could find lots of different areas where there's clues to the existence of God. Augustine, eternal truths point to an eternal mind. Thomas Aquinas has five ways to prove God's existence. The first three are cosmological, where you're arguing for either God as the cause, the uncaused cause of the universe, or some aspect of the universe. And first he argues from motion to an unmoved mover. Now you got to understand, movement for ancient philosophers was different than ours. I mean, physical movement is the most obvious form that we see, but movement is just synonymous with change. So to move from non-existence to existence is movement. And eventually you got to arrive at an unmoved mover, an uncaused cause. And then he argues from effects to a first uncaused cause. His most powerful argument is from contingent beings to a necessary being. Aquinas would say, look, let's say we take everything that exists. If everything that exists has the possibility of non-existence, okay, everything that exists is contingent, it has its dependent existence. If everything that exists has the possibility of non-existence, then given enough time, every possibility of non-existence will have been actualized. If we're given enough time, maybe billions of years, who knows, maybe thousands of years, every possibility for non-existence will have been actualized and nothing will exist. Problem is, if you go far enough back in time, eventually you would reach a point where that same scenario would have obtained and every possibility for non-existence would have been actualized and nothing would exist. But Aquinas, well-read in ancient philosophy, possibly the greatest medieval philosopher, he understood that from nothing, nothing comes. If something finite or contingent now is, something has to be eternal and necessary existence to ground all the dependent existence. Okay? This is not an argument for God as the cause of the beginning of the universe. This is an argument for God as the sustaining cause of our continued existence.
Well, okay. Looking at it like scientifically, cosmologists and physicians believe, or physics professors believe in something called the heat death of the universe. They believe that the law of entropy, which is all matter is spreading out until eventually there will be no energy left to actually produce anything.
There'll be energy, but it'll be used up. Yep.
They
useless. That, the death of.
But they claim that. In argument for the Big Bang, that there wasn't the beginning of time, that matter was just simply there. Well, if that's true, then the heat death of the universe would have happened a long time
ago. Yeah.
But logically, a nihilist, but I suppose a muriological nihilist.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, St. Bonaventure, a contemporary of Aquinas, likes that form of argumentation, as do I. But that's arguing for the beginning of the universe. Aquinas has got a conundrum. Because he's supposed to, he can only correct Aristotle so many times before he's no longer Aristotelian. Aristotle believed in an eternal universe, so Aquinas said, you cannot prove that the universe had a beginning in time. We accept that in faith in the scriptures, because of Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So, He did not believe that by reason we could prove the universe had a beginning, because then it would be a slam on Aristotle. He believed, because it's always possible that an eternal creator could have created an eternal effect. Now, I think he did, where the laws of logic and things like that are based on his eternal nature, but there was never a time when the laws of logic didn't exist. So Aquinas is arguing, you know, if there ever was nothing, then nothing would now exist. But he's not arguing that there was a time when there was nothing. Now, there would have been nothing if everything now is contingent. But this argument proves that everything could not be contingent. There has to be something that is totally necessary, that cannot not exist, that must exist, that it's actually undeniable that it exists. It exists not with logical necessity, but existential necessity. It is actually undeniable that it exists, and that must ground the continuing existence of everything else. Now, if we move and skip ahead to St. Bonaventure, St. Bonaventure says, no, we can prove that the universe had a beginning. Now, they had shabby science to prove it, because it was still a geocentric world in their way of cosmology, the way they thought. So he's saying that, for the time it takes the moon to move around the Earth, that's 1 month. For the time it takes the sun to move around the Earth, that's a whole year. So he's got it all, the Earth, And so by doing that, though, Bonaventure shows if the universe is eternal, then the amount of times the moon went around the Earth would be identical to the amount of times they would both be infinite. Yet, the moon has gone around the Earth 12 times as many times as the sun. So it's really bad science, but it's good logic. And, what?
I am a geocentrist as a matter of navigation, and also, if we're to claim the universe,
What he's pointing at, and this is something where most scientists are lousy philosophers, because they hold to relativity. Relativity says everything in the universe is moving. There is no stationary point. So when we, just to say that the sun revolves around the Earth, we have to treat the Earth like it's stationary, and it's not. So everything's moving in relation to everything else. So it's rather arbitrary that we pick one spot to be stationary. And so technically, if we're going to be real scientifically precise, you'd have a hard time deciding between geocentric and heliocentric. It's kind of like, well, if we inhabit this planet, why not make it the fixed point? So it's kind of like relativity teaches everything is relative, the physical world, everything is moving, nothing is staying still, except when we dogmatically declare that shows you how tentative science should be.
Yep. The one of the speakers at the conference, Pablo,
mm-hmm.
that described that, where he was talking about the conical shape of the universe, and he had that diagram of shooting through space and the whole universe. Was it him that showed that? I'm trying to remember.
He's just showing the movement. I don't know if he made any statement. I didn't stay for his whole talk, so I don't know if he made any statement about it. But the thing is, now, let me say this. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying Christians should argue for a geocentric. If Blake decides that's what he wants to do, that's fine. But there's just certain things that are accepted. And the thing is, if the sun's not dependent on the Earth, the Earth's dependent on the sun. So, I'll go with them. But with Blake's point is well taken, that everything is moving relative to everything else. So just to make any measurements, you got to just assume. I mean, when a cop's running radar, if his vehicle is coming 60 miles an hour towards your car, and you're coming 60 miles an hour towards him, the old radars would read 120 miles. And then the cop would have to look down at his own speedometer and do the math. Now the radar does the math for you, but really the radar is getting a speed of 120 miles an hour and then transferring that based on the radar also hitting the pavement and showing how fast the patrol car is going. But the fact of the matter is, if that car is coming towards you 120 miles an hour, doesn't mean it's traveling 120 miles an hour. It's relative to you, and you're moving towards them at 60 miles an hour. Now, having said that, the Earth is rotating, and it's also revolving. So, I mean, so all these things are like, yeah. So much. That's why the knowledge, the ancients, yeah. There you go. You say, and then you just bring in the curvature of the Earth, and that really settles it. So, but the ancients understood that how tentative. Sense, at least when they refuted the Milesian school, how tentative sense knowledge is, or knowledge through sense perception, versus our knowledge of universal, unchanging ideas and the laws of logic and mathematics, and things that we can know with certainty. But you know, those are Aquinas's first three arguments there. Then he's got like a moral argument from degrees of perfection to the most perfect being, that we wouldn't be able to say, well, this is good, but this is better, this is best, this is bad, unless we got some idea of perfection. And that's it's a Platonic argument used by an Aristotelian. And then he says, when the mindless things of nature move towards the same goals, such as acorns growing up to be oak trees and not apple trees, it shows that there's got to be a mind behind the mindless things of nature and moving them and governing them in the right direction. So this is a design argument. And by the way, even if evolution was true, this would still work well, which is why I think the Roman Catholic Church doesn't have a problem. The last few popes haven't had a problem with evolution because they're so into Aquinas' ways to prove God's existence, that as long as there's a mind behind evolution, they don't really have a problem with it. But certainly that fifth way, I think it's a good way to argue for God's existence, and it doesn't need evolution. And of course, Aquinas never even heard of evolution. Well, you've heard it. That's another thing, another lie. Evolution is not a new view. You know, about 500 years before Christ, you had Greek thinkers who were evolutionists. They said, well, living things got to come from somewhere. We don't believe in God. We don't believe in the myths. We don't believe the gods did it. The living stuff must have spontaneously come from the non-living material. And they even did experiments where they took dirty clothes, some decaying meat, threw the stuff down, left it in a box over the weekend, showed up on Monday morning, and there's flies, there's maggots, there's all kinds of, you know, said, wow. Life evolved from non-life. It wasn't until Louis Pasteur, where you kind of seal it, you make it a closed system, so there's nothing coming in from the outside, no living organisms coming in from the outside, and he disproved spontaneous generation, which should have been considered the death blow to evolution. Evolution assumes, evolutionists will tell you spontaneous generation doesn't happen, but it did happen at least once.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just like, what in the world are you talking about? Now Anselm's, he had two different ontological arguments. He's just trying to prove that God, by definition, must exist. So here's the ontological argument. I need to write that one down. I don't use it much. I don't like it. I think there's ways to make it work, but the ontological argument, basically, I'll simplify it. God, by definition, once we define what we mean by God, we find out that he must exist. So it's logically impossible for God to not exist. Okay? And so one form here, God by definition has all perfections. He considered existence a perfection, therefore the greatest conceivable being must exist. So God by definition is the greatest being we could imagine. Well, if we imagine the greatest possible being, he would have to have every possible perfection, every good attribute, and Anselm considered one of those attributes, one of those perfections, existence. Well, it actually works unless you say what Immanuel Kant said, and that's what most philosophers, Christian and non-Christian, admit, and that is that they no longer consider existence a perfection. In other words, if you're talking about the attributes of something, like the attributes of this book, its color, its weight, its size, the words inside it, the pages and all, you can describe all the attributes you want. Existence isn't one of those attributes. Existence just says, okay, well, now we got the idea of it with all its attributes, but does it exist? That's a whole separate question. And so in that sense, most philosophers today, Christian and non-Christian, reject that form of the ontological argument, that existence is not a perfection. So yes, we define God as having all possible perfections. Great. Now we've got the idea of God, but does God really exist? That's a whole separate issue. The way Anselm portrayed the second way that he gave the ontological argument is harder to refute, and that is this: that necessary being cannot not exist, therefore necessary being must exist. Here's the way, it's called modal logic. Alvin Plantinga is the expert on this nowadays. But modal logic would say the modes of existence. You have impossible existence, things that could not possibly exist. Okay? So they're not real being. You can't have square circles. Okay? So impossible beings. Then you got possible or contingent things. Things that could possibly exist, but also could possibly not exist. For instance, I am a possible being. You're a possible being. Because there was a time when we didn't exist. And then there's necessary being or necessary existence. So rationally, this brings up every possibility. There's the impossible beings, then there's possible beings, which could exist, could not exist, and then we can envision of a necessary being which cannot not exist, must exist. Well, when you look at the idea of a necessary being, it's a being that cannot not exist. To say that a being that cannot not exist does not exist is a contradiction. Hence, a necessary being must exist. Okay? He's saying that basically, God is by definition a necessary being. That's the way we explain it, the concept. And he's saying that once you have that concept, you see that it's a contradiction to say that that being does not exist. Now, Aquinas would say no. Aristotle would say no. But that's because they believe you can never get from the realm of ideas to the realm of being. You have to start in the realm of being. That's what the Aristotelians are. And so they would say through sleight of hand, Anselm has left the realm of ideas and entered the realm of being. But they don't think that the argument goes that way. Now, using modal logic, we could fill in the blanks and capture what's actually being said. Because Gonolo, the monk that opposed Anselm, just didn't really understand him. He thought, well, then the most perfect island can exist. It's like, no, that's an incoherent, you know, you can't have an eternal unchanging island, but you can have an eternal unchanging God. So you got to have the coherent idea of the most perfect being. But in modal logic, they would talk about every possible world. So you have possible worlds. Now this has nothing to do, possible worlds has nothing to do with the multiverse view of scientists. These are not real worlds that exist, okay? There's only, this view would say there's only one actual world, but there's many possible worlds. A possible world is any world that's not an impossible world. For instance, a world where there's a God greater than God, that's an impossible world. It's impossible for anything to be greater than God. Okay? And so you're looking at different logically possible worlds. A world where I didn't show up today. If everything else is the same except I just didn't show up, that's a different possible world. So if each possible world, if these are events in the possible world, and you just get one of these events different, from there it's a different possible world. Okay? If I chose to grow out my hair and try to pick it and bring back a 1970s fro, that's a different possible world. But that's not the world that has been actualized. And unless it's against my will, that world will never be actualized, okay? We don't repeat, most of us do not repeat the mistakes we made in the 1970s. And the ones that do, they get elected to Congress and the White House. So here, Plantinga says, if we're going to say, if we have the concept of the greatest possible being, then the greatest possible being, now in this idea of the world, that contains everything, not just what's created, but if there's a creator, the creator too. They say, well, the greatest possible being must exist as the greatest possible being in every possible world. Because if the greatest possible being doesn't exist in every possible world, as the greatest being in every one of those possible worlds, then I can conceive of a being greater. The one that is the greatest possible being in every possible world. Guess what, though? Alvin Plantinga points out the actual world, well, the actual world has to be a possible world. Because it's either a possible world or an impossible world. Since it was actualized, it had to be a possible world. So if the actual world is one of the possible worlds, if the greatest possible being has to exist as the greatest being in every possible world, he's got to exist in this possible world. Okay? So that is, and now Norman Geisler is a Thomist. So Geisler says, yeah, Alvin Plantinga, one of the most brilliant philosophers, Christian or non-Christian alive, that it's a valid ontological argument. But here's why Geisler accepts the argument but still rejects the ontological argument. Geisler says, Plantinga still, though, has to assume the existence of an actual world, so he has to leave the realm of ideas and possibility, the hypothetical realm, enter into the actual world, so it's actually a sophisticated cosmological argument and not really an ontological argument. And here's the clincher. Because Norman Geisler says it's always logically possible that nothing exists. See, Aquinas would say God has to exist once we acknowledge the fact that something exists. If some finite limited thing exists, infinite being must exist to ground it. So Aquinas would say God exists with absolute certainty, but it's not logical certainty, it's actual certainty or existential certainty. If something exists, God must exist. Okay? Anselm is saying God exists even if there isn't an actual world. But Geisler, being a good Thomist, says, but he has, Plantinga has to acknowledge the actual world because it's always logically possible that nothing exists. I'll just say this, and this is about being good philosophers, we've got to ask questions. There's another way of writing nothing exists, and it's this way. Nothing is non-being, and to have existence, to have being, you could say nothing exists. Another way of saying that is non-being is being, which has been used as the classical definition, the classical presentation of a contradiction. And contradictions can't be true. So I'm open to the possibility that Plantinga's ontological argument may work, because it's impossible for absolutely nothing to exist. Okay? So I got a question mark about the ontological argument there. Now I won't bring the ontological argument up. I did not understand the ontological argument when I had a philosophy course. I didn't understand when we had philosophy of religion. So it was about halfway through my master's degree when all of a sudden it dawned on me what Anselm was saying, and I saw the power in it, and I'm still not sure. Is Geisler right? So in other words, Plantinga's argument is valid, but is it a cosmological argument or is it an ontological? So I still suspend judgment on the ontological argument, but I do think it's interesting that Geisler says, to prove his point, that it's always logically possible that nothing exists, yet to spell out nothing exists is to say it's always logically possible that non-being is being. Yeah, so whatever the case, I think when we say absolute truth must exist, it has to exist, because to say there is no, to deny it, to say there is no absolute truth is self-refuting. So I think that's kind of a form of the ontological argument. But even again there, it takes us to Descartes, who liked the ontological argument. And he's saying, I think, therefore I am. Aquinas would say, no, you think because you are a thinking being. Being, you had to be there before you could think. So even when we say absolute truth must exist, because in order to deny the existence of absolute truth, it would be self-refuting, Aquinas would probably still say, yeah, but you have to exist in order to make that denial. So Aquinas isn't into logical necessity. That's just the world of ideas. He's into actual undeniability. He would argue it's actually undeniable that God exists.
So, modal logic, though, it seems to be trying to form a bridge between ideas and reality. For instance, physicalism has proven false just by the notion of a philosophical body, which is something that looks human, acts human, everything just does not have consciousness. And the argument was, it's logically possible that all life has no consciousness, but based on being philosophical zombies, such is not the case, therefore physicalism is false.
I think without a human soul, we are zombies.
But since such is not the case, physicalism is false. So we have a bridge now between the world of ideas and the physical world, the observable world. This is actually kind of what led me to be a Platonist, because I concluded that the soul has to be an idea or a form, as it uses consciousness. But if ontology or the connection in modal logic that we're making, if that's rejected, where do most philosophers stand on modal logic?
Modal logic is kind of the cool thing. So a lot of guys are jumping on the bandwagon. But this has been a big issue throughout philosophy. Can we go from the world of ideas to the physical realm, or supposed to be talking about the physical realm? Can we go from the world of ideas to the realm of real existence? Now, for Plato, it's a given, because the ultimately real is the world of ideas. So there's a sense where Plato was an idealist, where the only ultimately real things are ideas. But he's also a realist because he believes those real ideas are real. And so he's one of those, usually a guy's either a realist or an idealist. Only ideas exist? No, there is a reality outside my mind. Plato's one of those weird guys that is both. But for most philosophers throughout history, it's been difficult, if not unwarranted, to make the jump from ideas to reality. Aquinas would argue with Aristotle, it's unwarranted. You've got to start in the realm of reality, the realm of being. If Norman Geisler had his way, I'm sure he had a tug of war with Paul Feinberg. Metaphysics would have preceded, the section on metaphysics would have preceded the section on epistemology, because you got to have a knowing being before you could start knowing.
So my question to you then is, I know what I believe on this, but do you believe that abstract objects, given that they exist in a different reality than this one, do abstract objects interact with us, with reality?
Yeah, I think they do, and I wouldn't even say they exist in a different reality, maybe a different realm of the same reality. And I'm not a strict Thomist. I don't even think Geisler is a strict Thomist, because he will use the Kalam cosmological argument, which is something that Aquinas would never do. And on Monday I wake up and I feel like an Augustinian, which is be a form of Platonism. But then on Tuesday, I wake up and I feel like a Thomist. But I do think, even with the active intellect, we're never going to be able to fully abstract moral laws and abstract truths from a mound of dirt. And that was Gordon Clark's point. So I think there's... I think if we could take an Augustinian... kind of a Stuart Hackett, Augustinian, Thomistic epistemology, and blend them all into one, to where you've got these innate categories of the mind, Stuart Hackett. There's a sense where God still has to illuminate us, turn the light on for us to know something. But if we put those innate ideas in the subconscious, and they only become conscious in our current existence when they're triggered by sense experience, at least the first time that we deal with those ideas. If we've got sense experience triggering innate ideas from the subconscious to the conscious, so that we start out with a conscious mind as a blank slate, then we've got kind of the best of both worlds. But the idea that we're just totally a blank slate, I just don't see it.
I am one individual being. The number one exists. I mean, unless we want to claim that mathematics is a game, then that's absolutely
no. No, I believe numbers are real. Yeah. I believe numbers exist, but I believe they exist as eternal, unchanging ideas in the mind of God, but they are real ideas. And that not just doing science, but even doing math, we're thinking God's thoughts after him. Yeah. Now, I will... the more I learn about philosophy and what makes sense, the more I'm convinced Christianity is true. It just, I mean, I really think that, I think the choice is either a robust philosophy where we can joyfully be learners within Christianity. The choice is between that and being like Heidegger, an existentialist, where man's just tossed into existence with no rhyme or reason to it. We're just thrust into existence and there's no meaning. Everything's without meaning and all. So I think the choice is either the triune God or the Bible. In the end, and I'm not a presuppositionalist. I think this is, we realize this after reasoning. We don't start with it, but I think the choice in the end is going to be between a triune God, or we're just kind of thrust into existence. And
joyful philosophy is the best of gospel. We schedule
a debate,
but it's fun.
What's that? Yeah.
Can we schedule a debate?
There are gluttons for punishment. And
even going back to these possible worlds and actual worlds and yada yada, we kind of came back to our little discussion during the break about ancient aliens. Mm-hmm. You know, that if aliens exist on other planets, then God has to, I'm going to leap here. God has to exist, therefore Jesus has to exist. Romans says Christ died once and for all.
Yeah.
Does that mean he died for them too? Well, he died on this planet. You know?
Well, no, and that's where I think
it starts falling apart.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Bible makes it pretty clear that there's three kinds of rational beings. The Muslims add a fourth kind, the jinn,
yeah.
What we call the genies. The genie between the humans and the angels, but the Bible, the only kinds of rational beings on the level of human rationality or above, the human, angelic, and divine, the three divine persons, the one true God. That's one point I would make. Number two, spirit beings were not created with bodies, but it doesn't mean they cannot take bodily form. We see even angels taking on bodily form, and we see Satan speaking through a serpent. Number three, demons have disobeyed God in so many different ways. If they wanted to inhabit a planet, it wouldn't shock me in the least. But I don't see... The thing is, for me, the key, and this is what gives me peace about aliens, Second Timothy 3:16-17. I've seen so much evidence that the Bible is God's word that I'm not going to be shaken from that. By the grace of God, I will not be shaken from that. Well, 2 Timothy 3:16-17 not only tells us that every scripture is inspired by God, all scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, correction, rebuke, training, and righteousness, but that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work. If intelligent life exists on other planets, that verse tells us we don't have a need to know. Because we've been given everything that we need to live a godly life in this scripture. So if an entity appears to me and says he's from another planet, I don't even have to know if he's from another planet or not. All I know is I got to test what he teaches with the scriptures. John says, test the spirits to see if they're from God. If they don't confess Jesus, the true Jesus of the Bible, they're not from God. Paul says that no one can say Jesus is Lord. By the demon, you know, you can only say, you know, it's got to be the Holy Spirit that enables us to say that. You can't say Jesus is accursed by the Holy Spirit. So we really don't have we may not have a need to know. But I will say this. If there are beings on other that God created on other planets, and they're intelligent beings, and they're fallen, I see no reason why we should start twisting the scriptures. Well, if there are intelligent beings on other planets, they would be either fallen or unfallen. If they're unfallen, they don't need salvation. If they're fallen, either God could provide salvation or he could choose not to. He didn't choose to provide salvation for angelic beings. So, now let me say this too. Angels are called spirit beings. I would assume that if some angels have what we would describe as physical bodies, I would say it's because they chose to take on those bodies. And it seems to me that it was out of God's will, unless it was for purposes of an appearance, like the angels appearing to Abraham. So I would assume that these are fallen angels that have chosen to leave their own domain, like Jude says, talking about the sons of God who left their proper domain, took on bodily form, cohabited with female humans, and produced a race of giants, the Nephilim, who were hybrids, were neither human nor angelic, but a hybrid race, totally outside of God's creative purposes. But basically, well, it's just like some entity appears to me and says I'm from another planet. You know, it's like, hey, whatever. I'm going to start asking questions about Jesus. Usually you don't have to ask questions about Jesus to these so-called aliens. They start telling you. And they end up teaching New Age. I don't know if Gary Bates is quoting somebody or if he's just stating it himself. But he said, why? Oh, it might have even been you, Ross. But it's amazing how many Christian thinkers have investigated, done UFO research. But why in the world would these entities travel, go through all the trouble, if it were even possible, of traveling like billions of miles to come to this little dot planet Earth just to badmouth Christianity? Because that's the main theme of what they're saying. And it just seems like, you know what? These are demons. And so, if there's, and all angel means, angelos in the Greek is a messenger. So when a messenger comes with a message, you test the message and to determine whether they're from God or not from God. Okay? God sent good angels before. He could send good angels now. But if he does, they're going to be preaching the true gospel, true biblical gospel message. And so that's what gives me peace, is I don't have to know all the ins and all the outs. I will say this. I'm not open to the possibility that the Holy Spirit, let's say it is from the planet Dredge, the Dredgeites. I am not open to the possibility that the Holy Spirit will someday add a Dredge nature to redeem the Dredgeites. We have some, you know, Larry Norman had a song, Unidentified Flying Object, about the return of Christ, and one line in it, he wrote it in the 70s, I think. If there's life on other planets, I'm sure that he must know, and he's been there once already and has died to save their soul. And when I first heard that, I was so moved in the spirit. Talk about theology developing. I was so moved in the spirit. I thought, oh, that is so true. Then as I studied theology, I realized, oh, that is so false. could God become a Dredgeite? Yeah, it's hypothetically possible. But could God become a human? Yes, and it happened. So the answer now with Jesus, the question is not, could God the Son become a Dredgeite? It's, could God the Son, who is also fully human now, become a Dredgeite? And it's like, exactly. No.
So I'm saying in Romans, Christ died once.
Yeah.
For all. He's not going to other planets.
Yep.
Dying.
Yep. So there, as far as I'm concerned,
literally, taking it literally.
If I don't think there's life on other planets, but if there was life on other planets, I would say, well, they're not humans, and they're not divine. I'd classify them and group them in with the angels. How they got their bodies, I don't even want to know. Okay?
Well, the next thing, how do they get this physical
machine.
Mm.
Called a UFO, if that's even physically real. I don't know.
Yeah, no, they materialize, dematerialize at will. They can travel several thousand miles an hour and make perfect 90-degree turns, which violates the laws of physics. They can morph into 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 and then morph back in. They just show up on the radar. It's not like we're tracking them from somewhere else. They just disappear off the radar. No, these things manifest. The aliens and the craft they ride manifest themselves physically, but they're actually non-corporeal. They're non-physical. And most UFO researchers, even ones who aren't Christians, will let you know. They refer to them as extra-dimensional or interdimensional. They no longer see them as coming from out there. They just come from a whole other dimension and appear. And but we need a lot more research on it. The book I'm writing right now, I got one chapter on what I call paranormal apologetics. We need Christian apologists to provide explanations for the paranormal activities going on out there. I mean, how many people have told you that Bigfoot has been seen to materialize and dematerialize? Bigfoot has been conjured up through use of the Ouija board. Something's going on here. And then you get the same...
Bigfoot shows up and says, L. Ron Hubbard is right.
Mm-hmm.
We got problems.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If anybody knows where L. Ron Hubbard's views lead, just look at how he died.
Yeah.
Like Howard Hughes and all. Okay.
Well, he said right from the beginning, the best way to get rich is to create a religion.
Yep, yep. Yeah, yep. And he was a sci-fi writer, and he turned to sci-fi. But I think he actually started believing it eventually. And he died pretty much insane. Okay, so now the teleological argument, the most famous one, we showed Aquinas is there, but the most famous one was William Paley. He said you walk into a wilderness and you see a watch, even if you never saw a watch before, and you look at it and you see how it's operating, you see it was designed for a purpose. And then he talks about how advanced the human eye is. But believe me, it's impossible for something to evolve into the human eye. Okay? You're talking millions, if not billions, of years of something that just does not work.
Well,
okay.
First, the lungs or the diaphragm.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you even got the evolution from reptiles to birds. You got it in totally different. One, the design of the lungs is sacs. The other one is tubes. Whatever the intermediate form was, it wouldn't be able to breathe. So how's it going to last for like a million years until it evolves into a bird? Evolutionists have proven everything except how something came from nothing, life came from non-life, multi-celled animals came from single-celled animals, animals with backbones came from animals without backbones. So in other words, evolutionists have proven everything except evolution. Yeah. All they've shown is gradual change within a major type or species, whatever that means. And creationists are fine with that. The teleological argument, this is taken on new strength with Michael Behe's Irreducible Complexity. He has shown that Charles Darwin did not know what occurred on the submolecular level. Okay? It was a black box. They didn't know. They weren't able to open it up. Now we have. Charles Darwin assumed that in the submolecular level, everything is simple. And we think things are complex because there's a bunch of simple things put together. And that's easier to explain for an evolutionist than if everything is complex down there. We've gone to the submolecular level, and Michael Behe says in his book, Darwin's Black Box, we find entities on the submolecular level that are as complicated, like the bacterium flagellum is one example that he gives, the blood clotting system, another example, but there are entities on the submolecular level that are as complex as spaceships or computers, yet they're irreducibly complex. which means if you remove one part or if one part doesn't function right, the whole thing dies out. And so, in other words, they're as complicated as spaceships or computers, but they had to be made that way. They couldn't be any less complex, because then they wouldn't survive to evolve into something else. Okay? So he receives a lot of flack. He's a really quiet guy.
I like that.
I met him in North Carolina. He's like a nominal Catholic. This is not like these are fanatical evangelical Christians that are teaching. He's just a microbiology professor at Lehigh University. And I'm shocked he still has his job.
Yeah, you can look him up online. I got his book. There's a lot of people that are trashing on his book. Because they're atheists.
Yeah, and they still really, he hasn't really been answered in any kind of coherent way.
No.
Moral laws, the absolute moral laws need an absolute moral lawgiver. Let me just say that, look. We do make moral decisions. Where do the moral laws come from? So the atheist could say, well, the moral laws come from the individual. The final arbiter in what is right and what is wrong is each individual. Problem with that is then you can't condemn Adolf Hitler's actions as evil. Even atheists want to condemn Adolf Hitler's actions as evil. So then they could say, okay, well, then the moral law comes from each society. But there's a problem with that. Because if the moral law comes from each society, that each society is the final arbiter. Our society has no business judging the Taliban as wrong, ISIS as wrong, Nazi Germany as wrong. Each society determines. You can't even condemn Southern society before the 1860s for having slavery. Each society determines. Any moral reformer like Martin Luther King Jr. automatically is an evil guy because the society determines what is right. If you're trying to reform your culture, you're wrong. Culture is always right. But even the atheists want to condemn the Taliban. So then they could say, well, let's move it to a world consensus. Number one, I'm not even sure what world consensus is. Am I supposed to trust CNN when they tell me the latest poll says, you know, so what is the world consensus? But it seems that we've had some world consensus in the past where we thought the world was flat. You got to go back a lot further than people think, by the way, for that. But it was wrong then. It used to be the world consensus that the female was just property of the male. She had no rights. Well, we were wrong with that. And it used to be the world consensus that you could enslave somebody just because of the color of their skin. We were wrong about that. So what makes us think world consensus is right? And besides that, even the atheist tries to change the world consensus.
Absolutely. Yeah.
They fight for human rights and say, no, we need this, we need that, blah, blah, blah. And they're trying to change the world consensus. So, and then they condemn the actions of the past and try to build a better future, so they act like this moral standard they're appealing to doesn't change with time. Okay? So you put that all together, even the atheist acts like there is a moral standard above all individuals, above all societies, above any world consensus, and it's a moral standard that doesn't change with time.
But then the materialist.
What's that?
Then the materialist.
Yeah, it doesn't work at all. Morality doesn't work. Honesty doesn't work. To be a good scientist, you gotta report the results of your experiment honestly, but you can't even put honesty in a test tube. If you look ahead to the ethics, I give this argument. And the argument for the absolute moral law on ethics, page 5. So if you go further out of the ethics section, it's the whole second section. You need Jesus then. You gotta go beyond that. Go beyond
way in the back.
Beyond philosophy. Okay, yeah. And then see where it says argument for the absolute moral law. The moral law doesn't ultimately come from within each individual, for then we cannot condemn the actions of another individual like Hitler is wrong. It doesn't come from each society, for then one society can't condemn another society like Nazi Germany. By the way, this is my moral argument. I mean, you can find C.S. Lewis in it, but I do the last step. I don't know if anyone else has taken it. But then number three, the moral law doesn't ultimately come from a world consensus. The world consensus is not infallible. It only adds men quantitatively. We need a moral law qualitatively above others. And even the atheist tries to change the world consensus. So the atheist, with his actions speak louder than his words. In his actions, he acknowledges a moral law above all individuals, above all societies, and above any world consensus. And he acts like this moral law is eternal and unchanging because he condemns the actions of the past, tries to build a better future. So they actually live like there's a moral law above all individuals, above all societies, above any world consensus, and the moral law doesn't change with time. This necessitates the existence of an absolute moral lawgiver, because moral laws don't describe the way things are. You know, it doesn't say murder is. It prescribes the way things ought to be. It says murder is wrong. One ought not to murder. So prescriptive laws need a prescriber. Try to get a prescription medication without a signature of the prescriber, the doctor. So the atheist lives like there's a moral law above all individuals, above all societies, above any moral consensus, and the moral law doesn't change with time. Since moral laws are prescriptive and not descriptive, that means they act as if there's a moral lawgiver above all individuals, above all societies, above any world consensus, and the moral lawgiver doesn't change with time.
Soon enough, that argument,
you see Neil
deGrasse Tyson, who's that? The guy who does the show. Oh, I can't think of the Cosmos shows.
He's a glorified museum operator.
Oh, yeah.
I love his show.
The moral law.
He could do that if he wants. He could shout that from the rooftop, and I'll shout my argument from the rooftop and let the people decide who's coherent. What do you call it then? Is he the black gentleman?
Yeah.
Okay.
Show, by the way. Get it wrong, but yeah, he's definitely
what do you call it?
And I'm actually not gonna argue.
Okay, the absurdity of life without God. Absurdity of life without God. If God does not exist, life is absurd. We talked about the book of Ecclesiastes. You look at everything under the sun, and life is just striving after the wind. It's meaningless. Until you put God in the equation, Ecclesiastes chapter 12, nothing makes sense. So if you live your life like Mother Teresa, or if you live your life like Adolf Hitler, it doesn't matter. A million years from now, not only will you have died, everybody you ever influenced for supposed good or bad, whatever that means, will have ceased to exist. Eventually, the whole universe is going to blow up. Life is totally without meaning if there is no God. If there's no eternal meaning, eternal significance, then the temporary. You could add up all the temporary significance you want. You know, Michael Martin said, "Yeah, I could. My life could be very meaningful." I said, "Look, you can worship a car if you want, but that doesn't mean that your life is not absurd because you worshiped a car while you existed and now you cease to exist. So if God does not exist, life is totally absurd." C.S. Lewis's argument from reason, we touched on that a little bit, that human reason must have a rational cause if we're going to be justified in trusting what our reason tells us. Okay? And So whatever the case, I think from the arguments for God's existence, we can see that it is coherent that God exists. Now, what we've got to do next week, we're already running overtime. Next week, I'm going to probably give you a two-sentence overview of how we can talk about God and a two-sentence overview about can we experience God. And then we're going to have to spend the rest of the first segment, maybe even the first two, on the problem of evil. And then after that, we got to get into, ethics. Now, keep in mind, the philosophy course ends on page 59, so we don't have to get as far as the other ones. But I'm probably just going to look at the title, and then just give you a two sentence answer on some of these. And you can read the notes, read the textbook. If possible, take as many of the tests as you can. Your open book, open note, turn them in. If you can turn your paper in, that's fine. If not, I'll have to give you my address, and then you can mail it to me. And your paper doesn't have to be as philosophically profound as Blake's to get an A. So just do it.